Ladies and gentlemen, you can take your seats. We're about to begin. My name is Bob Lewis. I'm chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our first summer fall session of our 11th year of J Talks, as we call them. We've got a lively topic tonight and a provocative guest. John Cook is editor-in-chief of Gawker, the irreverent website that has broken so many stories, including the much-debated one about Toronto's mayor and crack cocaine allegations. We're grateful to BMO Financial Group, and especially to Paul Deegan, Vice President, Government and Public Relations, for his and their support of this series of talks. We're also pleased that CPAC, the cable public affairs channel, is broadcasting tonight's event across the country. And with that, let me briefly introduce tonight's moderator. Jeffrey Dvorkin is a lecturer and the program director for the journalism program at the University of Toronto Scarborough. He's a frequent commentator on media ethics. He has a blog called Now the Details. He is a former managing editor and chief journalist for CBC Radio, and he served as VP News and Information at NPR in Washington, D.C., and as NPR's ombudsman. Jeff, over to you to introduce John Cook and to begin the conversation.
Thank you very much, Bob. Good evening, everyone, and welcome. And welcome to John Cook. Delighted to have you with us. John is editor-in-chief of Gawker, as we all know. He's from Arlington, Virginia.
Alexandria.
Right, I knew there was an A in there somewhere. Went to the University of Wisconsin, has worked for a number of media organizations, including Mother Jones and Brills, and now is at Gawker. And I wanted, first of all, to thank you for creating this amazing flurry of interest around our mayor, Rob Ford. This is, as a recovering City Hall reporter myself, we never had this kind of opportunity to go after someone with such extraordinary detail. Why did Gawker feel the need to go for this story? What was it about the story that appealed?
Well, thank you for having me, and it's good to be here. One of the things we do is create characters, and that sounds like we create fiction, but we have sort of running, ongoing coverage of people in the news who have whatever foibles they have, whatever interesting characteristics they have. We sort of keep coming back to them, and Rob Ford had already kind of started becoming a Gawker character based on some of the outlandish and racist things that he had said. We had done a couple of posts on, like, look at, Toronto's crazy, look at what Toronto's crazy mayor said today. And he was already a sort of source of humor for us. And so when we got a tip, that there was a video of him smoking crack cocaine, he already sort of presented a persona that was, aside from just the facts of the story, which are crazy and interesting, but we were kind of like, well, it's Canada, it's not an American, is it really a story for us? The fact that he had already sort of, that our audience was already interested in him because of his outsized persona.
We're delighted that we could break your preconceptions about Canada. One of the things that Gawker does rather amazingly well, you publish sort of 20 editions or 20 posts a day, some days as many as 30. Mm-hmm. How big is your staff?
We have about a dozen people, staff and freelance weekend and night people.
And you publish content from other sites as well. It's not all, is it all Gawker content?
pardon me. It's all Gawker. The Gawker Media, the parent company, has 8 sites. Jezebel is our women's site. Deadspin is our sports site. And so we will often sort of share posts from one site to the other. And then when I or any of my staff sees something interesting on the internet that's not published professionally or formally at another outlet, we will ask occasionally if we can grab that and post it ourselves, and often we'll get permission. There was a woman, after the Newtown shootings, there was a woman who was the mother of a very troubled son, and she wrote, I think on her personal blog, a very anguished post saying, essentially, I am Adam Lanza's mother. I have a child who exhibits these behaviors, and this is how hard my life is. And we asked her if we could publish that on Gawker, because it was this sort of fascinating post of and a fascinating insight into a person's life that was sort of off the news. And so we do things like that.
That's kind of mainstream journalism, really. But you seem to have developed a particular ability to attract stories and ideas and approaches that are distinctly not mainstream. And one of the things that has been generated by your coverage of Rob Ford and the subsequent following in the Toronto media is the role of gossip as a generator of media. And I guess the truth is that journalists are gossips. It is their secret sin. Well, it's not so secret anymore, since you have now taken what is, as you've described it, stories that are exchanged after work in the bar, and then instead of just laughing and chuckling about them over a few drinks, you end up putting them on your website.
Yeah, I mean, that was the founding idea of the site. When Nick Denton, the owner of the company, originally envisioned envisioned it as a media gossip site, which it still is, but we've tried to sort of expand it to kind of be a national tabloid. But the original idea was that the real story is what the reporters are talking about in the bar after the paper goes to press, and so we want to surface those stories. And part of that is not just about getting gossip out there. It's a democratic idea. Like, reporters shouldn't be the only people who have access to this knowledge. There are so many stories out there that everybody knows about except for the audience. And we want everyone to know about that, because I'm sort of ideologically opposed to the idea of an elite group of self-selected professionals who get to know what's really happening and then keep that from their audience of plebes. And in many cases and in many sort of big stories, that's actually what tends to happen.
What do you think is a proper relationship then between what Gawker does and what so-called mainstream media do?
I mean, I don't know. We do what we do, I think a lot of mainstream publications are moving closer to our model of what to do in terms of their online strategies. There are a lot of if you look at the New York Times' web coverage, it often they sort of will frequently. I mean, there was a recent debate about a New York Times story that was edited. A story about Israel. I can't remember the specifics, but it was sort of edited on the site on the fly, and they eliminated some quotes. It was about AIPAC's efforts to lobby for a strike against Syria, and there were some quotes from AIPAC that were just sort of removed. That's not the kind of thing that, without notice, that's not the kind of thing that sort of jibes with the New York Times's self-professed rules about its journalism, but that's how they operate online, because that's where things are a little bit more free and Wild West.
Okay. All this sounds plausible. But in fact, according to the research I found over the last couple of days, you've moved your focus away from editorial to what your previous editor-in-chief,
Mr.
Mr. Delario, is that correct?
Delario, yeah.
Delario. called Traffic Whoring and SEO, Search Engine Optimization, Bomb Throws. Mm-hmm. So is this simply about collecting eyeballs, or is it about doing journalism? Or is it both?
Well, I don't like to call it journalism because I like to have a ready answer to a question I'm often asked, which is, how do you call yourself a journalist? And I don't. I'm a reporter and an editor.
Reporters and editors are journalists too, you know.
Well, I object to the professionalization of those jobs.
Is it because if you're a professional, then you can be held to account?
No, it's because professionalization is a way of building up barriers to keep little people out. It's a way to create a priesthood, an elite of people who are anointed, who can do this stuff, but people who aren't trained, who haven't gone to journalism school, who haven't jumped through whatever hoops the professional class has established, are kept out. And I like a media culture and a reporting culture that invites anybody who wants to participate into it.
Well, what about standards? If anyone can participate, mm-hmm. And you're opposed to professionalism, the thing about being a professional is that you have to accept that there are certain standards of behavior and comportment. Doctors, lawyers, and journalists are among the group that often resists a professional standard because it forces them to be more accountable.
You know, I am accountable, and what we do at Gawker, we're accountable every day because our critics and our readers have exactly the same access, potentially, to eyeballs that we do, in the sense that if someone disagrees with us or thinks we've made a mistake, even just a person, you know, on Twitter can criticize us, and it can go it can get very big and go very wide very quickly. Our critics have the same printing press that we do. We obviously have a bigger audience, but anything that is any criticism of what we do that is substantive and substantial and if it's accurate has the potential to become immediately a very big problem for us, even if it's from just some reader or some commenter. If we make an error and someone notes that error in the comments, everybody can see it. Everybody who reads the story can see it. So, we are accountable in that way, and accountability is sort of baked into the way we operate. In terms of whether journalists are like lawyers or doctors, you know, the only professional standard, you know, the professional standards that we operate under are the standards that I hope anyone would operate under in their lives, which is honesty and truthfulness.
So I take it you're not hiring an ombudsman in the next couple of weeks.
Actually, I do want to hire an ombudsman.
Oh, well.
I do actually really like the idea.
We should talk about this later. But interestingly enough, Mr. Dolirio, when he asked for more responsibility over other Gawker Media properties, but after a controversial tenure, was told by your publisher that he was not responsible enough. Is that true, or is that just gossip?
I don't know where you get that gossip. That's your sandbagging.
I got it on Wikipedia, so it must be true.
No,
he was replaced by you because apparently you're more responsible.
AJ left of his own accord, and I did not want him to go, and Nick did not want him to go. I didn't want him to go because I had the best job in the world, and he was a great boss. Now he's making a ton of money at Spin Media, where he runs the.
But it sounds like the Gawker culture, the newsroom culture, inside Gawker, mm-hmm. sounds pretty rough and tumble.
You know, it's not. It's a really, it's a great place to work, actually.
Well, you would say that, since you're the most responsible.
No, I mean, in terms of, like, there's benefits, and you can take a paid sabbatical if you've been there for 4 years. There's a lot. We have catered breakfast and lunch every Monday. That doesn't have anything to do with what we do journalistically or reportingly. But no, I mean, it's a very collegial atmosphere, actually. Okay. It really is.
Couple of questions here about your comments policy. Mm-hmm. You've allowed comments to be fairly rough on your site. Is there a point beyond which you will not go, or we will not allow certain comments?
Well, so the comments is sort of where the company is really going and is focused right now, and it goes back to that sort of democratic idea of letting anybody participate in what we do, and erasing and eliminating the lines between reporters and editors and readers. Although I hope not in terms of salary, we're calling the publishing platform of what we do Kinja, and the idea is anybody who's a commenter on Gawker can create their own website, their own blog, which is sort of Tumblr-like. We're organizing the comments in such a way that anybody who starts a comment can control the responses to that comment. So if you comment on a Gawker site and you say something interesting, and then a troll comes in under you and says something stupid, you can X out that comment and it goes away. But it gives that power to the commenter to control the discussion, not to the writer.
And do you use the comments as a guide to future coverage?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do posts saying, you know, recently a story about Jay-Z and Beyonce's bodyguard, former bodyguard, was killed by the police. They had fired him a year ago, but he tried to break into someone's house in Florida, and police showed up and shot him. There was a story about that indicated that he had been fired by Jay-Z and Beyonce for a lewd act. And we did a post saying, what lewd act was he fired for? And the commenters answered. I mean, that, you know, and that is not just like, oh, I Googled and found out. It's, we have an audience that is an audience of people who have access to information, people who are in institutions that we cover, who are work in government, work in media. And they supply us with information in the comments all the time because we provide an anonymous system. We provide a system where people can create what we call a burner account. You can log into our site as a completely anonymous person. We don't log your IP address. If the Department of Justice subpoenas us saying, what was the IP address for this commenter, we don't have that record to give them. We've organized it deliberately in such a way to facilitate people anonymously providing us with information.
Who is your audience?
I mean, our audience is young, urban. You know, it's not mostly New York anymore. It's national. I think of my audience as me. Like, what am I interested in, or what are my writers interested in? Because I'm not interested in the Miley Cyrus stuff that we do. You know, we have Miley Cyrus experts who do that. It's what we want to see. It's what we're interested in. It's the things that we like and that we care about.
Have you had many lawsuits?
We've had a couple.
How have you done?
We've settled a few, you know, or settled one. One's ongoing with Hulk Hogan, who, to my astonishment, came up here and arm wrestled Rob Ford, which was sort of a bizarre. It's like the meeting of the Gawker enemies. It was, yeah.
I'd hate to see what the settlement is there. I mean, as I've said, you know, we love gossip, but we don't admit it. And I think what Gawker does is that they're just honest about it. But I got an email from a colleague who said she wasn't going to come to this evening, and I suggested that she might find it interesting, and she said, just like your comment on this, on her observation, she said, my stomach's just not up to being in the same room with John Cook, I'm afraid. What a creepy lot these guys are.
How are you guys doing? Is everyone's stomach okay?
So far, so good. All right. Well, but it does raise the question that a lot of people, especially in traditional journalism, and maybe older journalists too, are really offended by what you do.
We publish offensive things every day. I mean, I admit to that. I mean, you know, we get a lot of, we piss a lot of people off. I mean, I consider that part of my job. I take pleasure in writing and reporting and publishing things that someone doesn't want written, reported, or published. The subjects of our stories are often angry at us. I published a list of the, after Newtown, after the shooting, a paper in Rockland County, north of New York City, published in New York. Up until recently, you could, using the Freedom of Information law, get the names and addresses of anyone who was registered to own a handgun or a rifle in New York State. And so a paper in Rockland County did a map of where the guns are in your neighborhood, because they got this information and they distributed it on a map. And the gun nuts went crazy, and there were death threats against the editors and writers of the paper, and it became a big deal. Like, were these people invading privacy? And sort of in solidarity with them, I had sitting around my house a similar list for New York City, because I had gotten it a couple of years ago and never thought to put it on the internet because it was just a 400-page list of names. But I, in solidarity with them, put that up. Like, here's this list. Here's the same thing for New York City. And I put it up at 4:30 on the afternoon, and by the time I got home at 6:30, my voicemail at home was already filled with death threats and hate messages. My address was on the internet. My phone number, my mother's address at one point, was on the internet. I mean, it was a wave of hatred and anger and retribution. And you know, you just have to get used to it. Like, I'm.
But what is the purpose of? I hate to sound high-minded, but I tend to do that a little much these days. What's the purpose of coarsening our civic lives by publishing that kind of stuff, by enraging people to that extent? I mean, obviously, this search engine optimization and traffic whoring must be very effective for you to keep doing it.
Well, I mean, there's actually a difference between the traffic whoring stuff and that kind of stuff. I mean, that wasn't a high traffic post, really. I mean, it did well, but it wasn't like great. The traffic whoring is, you know, there are things that we anticipate might go viral that are not, you know, anything that would upset someone. There was a Chipotle ad that Chipotle produced an ad that was really well done and interesting about their opposition to the factory farming system. I don't know. Do you have Chipotle up here? It's right. Well, so. Yeah, so we did that, and we did that, and I mean, that's the traffic whoring stuff. That's where, like, oh, this is something people are gonna be interested in, and let's post it. And it's not just traffic whoring. It's all part of our job is to present things to an audience that they're gonna like, and that was a successful example of that. I actually really worked very hard to try to find some kind of anti-Chipotle story we could do to sort of cleanse the palate after giving them all of that great press, but it's actually, I couldn't,
you mentioned the Chipotle ad because it was on your top stories on your homepage this morning. And I just wanted to repeat some of these headlines here and get you to comment on why you think these were good stories. I'd just like to press you a little bit on your news judgment. So the first one was, this 3-minute commercial puts full-length Hollywood films to shame. What was that for?
Another commercial that we posted. It was a Thai telecommunications company had made a really good commercial, and it was a great little short film. The film the conceit of it was that there was a kid who the story was like, there's a guy at a restaurant who a soup restaurant. There's a little kid whose mother was sick, and he wanted some soup, and the guy gave him free soup, the kid free soup. And then flash forward 20 years, the guy who gave him the soup is in the hospital, and he's sick, and the hospital bill comes, and it's more than they can afford, and the doctor is the little kid that he gave the soup to, and the doctor says, but it was well done, and it was moving, and it was an interesting little short film, and we put it on the internet.
And the second top story is, Public masturbation declared legal in Sweden after landmark trial.
That's one of the best headlines we've ever published on Gawker. I love that headline. It's after landmark trial is like it's the sweet spot because it's supposed to be the idea that it's a landmark victory. I love that headline. It happened. It's true. In Sweden, there was a guy who was masturbating on a beach, and the Swedish High Court decided that if he wasn't masturbating at anybody, then it wasn't. Then it violated no criminal laws. I think that's important. That's newsworthy.
Well, I'm glad to hear this.
I mean, as we know with Rob Ford, we have international news is very important to us.
Exactly. So. The third one was the Chipotle ad, and then realtors speak run amok in insane listing for impossibly small studio. What was that about?
I mean, it was. An ad where the realtor was trying to obscure the reality of the apartment by using jargon.
Okay.
And we have an urban audience. People try to rent apartments, and the experience of reading an ad for an apartment reading out for an apartment that's cozy or whatever, and then you get there and it's a shithole. That's our readers are very familiar with that experience, so people like to read those kinds of stories because it's something they're familiar with.
And then there was this week in the tabloids, Honey Boo Boo. This is important.
Honey Boo Boo? I don't even know who Honey Boo Boo is. Honey Boo Boo is a reality show about a child. It's disgusting. It's vile that people put a child out there on a reality show. That post, by the way, was a Jezebel post that we shared over. I'm pretty sure.
Then it's okay.
Well, I'm just saying it didn't come from my shop. I think. But we cover Honey Boo Boo. We write about Honey Boo Boo. Rich Joswiak, one of our writers, is obsessed with Honey Boo Boo. It's a part of our culture. It's an important part of our culture, actually, that we as a society and as a culture are okay with and demand that cable networks put forth children to perform for us
and basically exploit them.
Yeah, but our coverage of that process is critical. I mean, our coverage of that process is from a perspective of this is not humane.
Okay, sounds like it's socially responsible and redeeming.
I would not use those words, but
all right. Well,
we're not socially responsible.
The last top story today was James Franco is gay.
So James Franco hates Gawker, I love these stories. James Franco doesn't like Gawker, and he's said that many times. And on his Instagram feed, for I don't know why, he published an image of a collage that he had created of himself walking down the street holding hands with a man in New York. There were like four images, and in one he's holding hands with a man, and another he's kissing the man, and the man's face is blurred out. And on that he had using Mac Paint or whatever, something, some kind of program, had written James Franco kissing a man in New York, Gawker high, or something to that effect. And published that on his Instagram account. It was a confirmation that James Franco is gay.
But okay.
And so we published it.
Is this relevant? Is this interesting?
Well,
is this necessary?
I could find you any number of stories about and interviews with James Franco in any number of traditional publications. He's an artist and an actor that people are interested in. Part of our cultural coverage involves following his Instagram account, and when he invites us to publish, put something up saying he's gay. I mean, James Franco, I don't know if he's gay. He toys with the idea. He thinks it's funny. I think it's funny too. When we did that headline, it was in jest. It was a joke between us and Jimmy.
Now you did you committed some allegedly serious journalism here. I don't know how that happened. Assad interview with Denis Kucinich, and McCain slaps back at Putin in scathing op-ed in Russian newspapers. So those are sort of kind of mainstream stories that you covered?
Yeah, we cover the news, and sort of aggregation, we cover the news. When a story happens, we pick it up, and I do like to think of Gawker as a place that you, if for some reason you didn't read anything else that day, you would still get a pretty good news digest and news diet. So we cover those stories. We also produce original reporting that,
okay.
You know.
You have this section called Journalisms.
It's Journalismism.
Journalismism?
Yes.
My typo, my bad. Russia airs fake footage of rebels using sarin gas. That was one today.
Yeah.
Next time, just ignore the breaking news story about the Navy Yard shooting, which was how most media got a lot of it wrong initially,
right.
As usual. Quote, you won't have a goddamn bit of coverage, goodbye, unquote. Upset Florida city councilor goes after a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good.
Mm.
Collected op-eds of Vladimir Putin. 22-year-old buys $250,000 apartment in New York.
Mm-hmm. That was a hit.
That's good. Dan Rather recaps the newsroom.
Dan Rather has been a Gawker contributor for 2 years now. And we've for the first two seasons of The Newsroom, which is a terrible, horrible television program on HBO, a sanctimonious, endlessly irritating show that I watch religiously just because I like the way it makes me feel. I like that anger. And Dan Rather, we invited him to recap it. We do occasionally, recapping is like you watch this TV show and you just basically recount what the episode was. We don't do it much anymore. We used to really obsessively like do recaps of Real Housewives of New Jersey and that kind of stuff. And we kind of let that fall by the wayside. But we asked Dan Rather to recap The Newsroom, and he loves the show.
And the penultimate one is why the Times rewrote the pro-Israel support for Syria strike that you mentioned.
Yes,
that's
yes.
Good. And then the last one by you is, if there are any children in the audience, perhaps they'd go out of the room for a moment, is Anal the Way to Go by John Cook.
Let me explain.
Please do.
There was like some guy, there was a blogger for the Spokane Spokesman Review, a reporter who had his own blog, and he had a headline on it that said, is anal the way to go? Or no, it said, when anal, the headline was, when anal is the way to go, or something. And it was a two-sentence blog post that was like, if you use a digital camera, if you use a digital alarm clock, when the power goes out, you won't wake up. And he had dropped two letters, two important letters that were supposed to follow the word anal. It was supposed to be analog.
Ah.
And that's funny.
Thank you for sharing
and
that.
And so I put it on the internet.
Absolutely. Let's get back to something a little closer to home, shall we? I think the Rob Ford story is still something that is very much ongoing, and one of the both blessings and criticisms that people had about Gawker's role in this was that you kind of set the stage for it in many ways. I mean, the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star were deeply involved as well, but then after you proclaimed this issue, you kind of walked away from it in a sense, kind of leaving mainstream media to clean up after you.
Well, I mean, I would dispute that a little bit in the sense that I did do some follow-up coverage. I mean, we were the first to by a matter of hours, but we were the first to identify the house that the photo of Rob Ford with Anthony Smith and others was taken in front of. I did a story about the man who showed up at that house looking for the video or looking for the kids who sold crack to Rob Ford that night to try to find the video and later returned and beat someone with a metal pipe. I did continue to write about it, but I mean, you know, there are. One answer is we don't have a Toronto bureau.
I think you are the Toronto bureau.
Yeah, but it came over the transom. It was a one-off story. It's not we don't cover Toronto or Toronto politics. That said, I admit that we will often do a story and then you know, and then just get the bang out of it and move on. It's sort of part of our, you know, we don't have beat reporters. So we don't have someone who's always going to be doing the same kind of story over and over. I mean, we roughly have like a culture guy and stuff like that, but our generally we're kind of, we're all general assignments, so people move on. And so you don't have that, you know, we're not organized around beats.
One of the frustrations that a lot of people expressed was that the video was there. People, some reporters, some journalists saw the video, yourself included. But then the public didn't really get a chance to examine it in any significant way. And so the problem, it seems to me, was that we were saying, journalists were saying, trust us, we've seen it, but we can't show it to you anymore. And somehow this seems to be more in the realm of gossip than in substantive journalism. Did that bother you at all?
It bothered me that we couldn't land the video. When John McCain released his health records in the 2008 presidential campaign, he assembled them in a room and invited reporters to come in with no cameras. They couldn't take photographs, and they could take notes and read over the health records, and then they went back and wrote their stories. I've never seen John McCain's health records. I trusted them. There are any number of stories where a reporter witnesses something and writes down what they witnessed, and we trust them. There are many stories where, you know, that are based on artifacts where I saw, you know, where, you know, according to documents obtained by the New York Times, but the New York Times often doesn't publish those documents because of source restrictions. So it's not uncommon for reporters to either witness an event or witness some kind of artifact and then go write about it without actually being able to present that artifact to people. In fact, you know, had this story happened 30 years ago, not that there was crack 30 years ago, but you know, had a newspaper reporter, had a Toronto Star reporter witnessed a film of the mayor of Toronto doing something untoward, they wouldn't have had the capability to put it.
I think that's a really interesting point, because 30 years ago, or even 5 years ago, the public would have been more inclined to say, okay, it's the Toronto Star and Gawker, and so we will trust the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail and Gawker because they have told us what they have seen, they've borne witness to this event. But social media has changed all that. People have different expectations now that if you are making an insinuation or an allegation, that the public, will be able to see it as well.
Yeah, pics are it didn't happen is the sort of internet jargon for that. And it, yeah, I mean, it was unusual for us to be writing about a video that we couldn't show to people. The normal story for us would be like, wow, look at this video.
And it's interesting to hear people in Toronto who don't believe this story for the simple reason that large media organizations are less and less trusted. And I wonder if the way this story rolled out exacerbated that lack of trust.
Yeah, it may have. I mean, frankly, I think there are a lot of people who wouldn't believe it if the video, and I hope it does eventually become available to the public. There are a lot of people who wouldn't believe it even after that. I mean, I think there's just sort of an ideological commitment to this man, and they would find there'd be Ford truthers. The way the story rolled out was not ideal, I felt my hand had been forced when CNN, I had tried to approach CNN, approached a number of places, but among them CNN, to try to see if I could find a way to get someone to pony up the money. And it was a long shot, it was a Hail Mary, but I figured I'd try. And CNN, contrary to the conditions of my sharing the information with them, told their reporter up here to reach out. They told him to reach out, and so the reporter up here reached out to a former Ford aide, and it got back to Ford, and at that point I thought it was just sort of out.
What about the ethical issue of paying for news? You raised a couple hundred thousand dollars. This now sets an first of all, I think it's wrong for a whole bunch of reasons, but it also changes the playing field now. Increasingly, people may say, "I've got a story, pay me for it." Mm-hmm. Doesn't that damage the nature of the journalistic relationship to create a normalization of checkbook journalism?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, checkbook journalism was normalized for many years.
In Britain than in North America, though.
The New York Times got an exclusive from a passenger on a surviving passenger from the Titanic. I think it was a crew member from the Titanic, in whenever that was, 1918, 1912, and they paid him for it. Obviously it's not the norm now, but it has been in the past. It is in England. The one of the most important public interest journalism stories in England of the last decade was the expenses scandal, where it was the Telegraph, I believe, that broke a huge story that members of parliament in England were expensing to the taxpayer things like the upkeep of the moat around their house, upkeep of second homes that they were renting out to other people, and they were also charging the taxpayer for the upkeep of those homes. All sorts of scandalous expenses. That story came about because the Telegraph paid somebody for a CD-ROM that had all of the expenses on it. I think that was a good thing. I think I'm glad that happened, and I don't think there's anything wrong with the Telegraph paying that person. If that's what it takes to land that story, I'm much more comfortable with that and whatever degradation you might have from like various sources expecting to get paid for things. We get people coming to us expecting to get paid for things all the time, and we will say no, because they're not worth it to us. And sometimes they'll say okay, and they'll give it to us anyway.
A good ploy. before we open it up for questions, I have one more issue that I'd like to toss your way. How did you feel about the fact that there were so many unnamed sources in the Rob Ford crack story? Specifically, the Globe and Mail published a follow-up where Rob Ford's brother Doug was allegedly involved with hashish selling back in the 80s, I believe, and they had 10 people who they claim knew about this, but none of them were willing to be quoted. Do you think that that's a story that deserves to be published if you don't have someone who's willing to come out in front of the story and say, yes, I saw X, Y, or Z?
Absolutely. I thought that was a great story, and I wish it had been published earlier than it was. I have no problem with anonymous sources. I think at this point we've got a savvy enough media culture in terms of the audience that people understand, when people understand that and take anonymous sourcing with the grain of salt that it often requires. When I read, I do. I think people are aware of the, you know, of how to read a story that's anonymously sourced versus one that's on the record. But, you know, a lot of the most important stories that we get are sourced anonymously, and they're sourced anonymously because there are people who have interests they need to protect and are often in danger. I mean, Ed Snowden comes to mind, who when that story first broke, he was anonymous. He wouldn't say who he was. He eventually took it on the record, but that's an important story. And you know, if that's what you have to do to protect the people who are giving you the information, I'm fine with that.
Rob Ford is playing the I'm the victim of the media card, and although the polls seem to indicate that he probably will not get reelected, we're not in the middle of a re-election campaign yet. My sense is that he might be able to ride this all the way back to City Hall. In no small way due to Gawker, the Toronto Star, and the Globe and Mail going after him. Is that a realistic assessment, do you think?
I did not go after him, and I don't think the Toronto Star or the Globe and Mail went after him. I wasn't out there, you know, beating the pavement looking for Rob Ford crack stories. If I had known they were out there, I probably would have. But, you know, this isn't going after him. This is, you know, this is reporting his documented behavior.
But members of the so-called Ford Nation mm-hmm. have filed complaints with the Ontario Press Council. The Star and the Globe have been hauled up before them, accused of doing bad journalism. And basically, a lot of people have said, I've heard this on the radio, so it must be true, that this was Gawker-inspired press coverage.
Well, I mean, it wasn't inspired by Gawker in the sense that the Toronto Star had been working on their story before we published ours. The Globe and Mail had been working on it for 18 months. I mean, those stories predated ours. The Toronto Star's coverage of his public drunkenness predated our, you know, me even really knowing anything like who he was, and wouldn't have been able to name him at that point. So, there was no inspiration. I don't think it was Gawker inspired, but you know, it's not going after him to report accurately on his public, in many cases, public behavior. And it's not going after him to report what you see. If someone shows you a video of the mayor of Toronto smoking crack, the appropriate response is to tell people about it.
But what about the presumption that may be a little old-fashioned now, but still operates at a number of media organizations, that you need two reliable sources before you go with a story? How many reliable sources did you have?
Well, there are not a lot of reliable sources in the crack selling community. And B, the reliable source in to some extent was myself, because I had seen it. And it was, you know, when, you know, learning that Robin Doolittle and Kevin Donovan had also seen it sort of was a relief, like, you know, to sort of buttress the credibility of the story, in terms of the way we operate and report, I don't have a hard and fast rule. I mean, anonymous sourcing is very similar. It depends on the story. There are some stories that are low wattage or innocuous or not really that serious, where I'm not going to be concerned about two sources. If I'm going to be reporting something that's actually that's heavy, then we're going to pay more attention to the sourcing. But it's a sliding scale. It's not like a hard and fast rule. For the Ford thing, you know, if the story was, hey man, I saw Rob Ford smoking crack, I wouldn't have done that story, and no one would have really paid attention to that story. If it was like Gawker says some anonymous crack dealer says Rob Ford smokes crack, no one would have credited it. But I didn't believe some crack dealer. I saw it. I saw it happening.
Thank you. I think we're ready for some questions now. Please use the microphone for the questions. Where's the microphone? Oh, there's one there. Is that the only one? Right behind you. And would you please provide your name, affiliation, if such exists?
Yes.
And hang on one second. I'm not finished.
Short.
Keep the question brief and provide a question.
Yeah.
Sir.
Thank you. Jeffrey, just a point of order to begin with. You mentioned at one point in time something about what the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star has seen. The Globe has never purported to have seen the crack cocaine video. So I think in terms of accuracy, that means... needs to be clear. Only the Toronto Star and only Gawker have seen this video. My question to John is, John, at one point in time in your writing, you indicated that the tipster had told you how he came into possession of this video. And I was wondering if you could tell us about that now.
I'm not quite sure. The tipster, to my knowledge, never actually possessed the video. The video is possessed by a different person that the tipster put me in contact with. So, in other words, the person who wrote an email to Gawker saying, I have a video of the Rob Ford smoking crack cocaine, didn't actually have the video. There was somebody else who had the video. I came to Toronto, met with the tipster, the tipster then took me to a place where that person who had the video got in a car and showed me the video.
Very quickly, how long was it between your seeing that video and your producing your piece?
Let me see. It was, I think, 2 days. I think I saw it. The timeline is not clear in my mind, but I came back from Toronto to New York, and I think spent basically one full day trying to see if I could find another media outlet. I talked to NBC News, CBS News, and CNN to see if I could come up with some way to get people to pony up. And I think it was the next day after that that I learned that CNN had told their person in Toronto to check it out, and it had gotten back to Ford.
Okay. Thanks very much.
You said when you...
Your name, please.
Oh, sorry. Olivia Glauberzon with BNN. I was just curious, you said that when you watched the Rob Ford video, you saw it yourself. What was it? Because, you know what, after this whole story broke, there was like a video circulating around Facebook, and I swear to God, it was called Make Your Own Rob Ford Crack Video, and the man in that video looked exactly like Rob Ford. And so what is it about the video you saw that convinced you that this was 100% legit?
I mean, you know, I saw that video that you're talking about, and that, you know, that was sort of cartoonish and amateurish compared to what this was. This was a very, very clear, very well-lit video that was unmistakably Rob Ford, and it was unmistakably genuine and real. The video that was circulating on Facebook was, to my eye, clearly, like, if I had seen that video, I would have been like, that could be anything. But the video that I saw was crystalline, and there was no mistaking it. And then I also had the.
Was there a distinct physical feature or something?
I mean, no, it was Rob Ford. I mean, it was you could see him very clearly.
I don't know. I saw
and
Rob
you could hear
Ford
his voice
on
as
a
well.
Saturday night, St. Paddy's Day. You know, we saw him stumbling outside the beer market, and I watched that Facebook Make Your Own Crack video, and I couldn't tell the two of them apart.
Well, that was his face juxtaposed onto someone else's body. So that it was his face in that video. But I think that Rob Ford's behavior subsequent to the publication of these stories, to me, absolutely confirms, erases any lingering doubt that anyone might have. You don't say to your staff after the publication of a fake video of you smoking crack cocaine, I know where the video is, let's go get it. Someone doesn't show up at the house where the video was produced with a steel pipe looking for the guys who sold the crack that was never sold so they could get the video that doesn't exist. I mean, this is... And, you know, the fact that the Toronto Police Department had apparently picked up this stuff on wiretaps prior to the publication of any story, I think it certainly spells it out for me.
Thank you.
My name is Steven Strauss. I'm a longtime journalist whose journalism school is what they call the supermarket tabloids. And I watched in them stories made up. And what drove the stories to be made up were pictures, which were really interesting, and so you wanted a story which was as interesting as the story, as the picture. So I wonder, in terms of what you do you feel this drive to try and come up with something that matches the visual that we can present, or is the fact that the commenters exist, does it actually keep you more honest than the tabloids used to be?
I mean, what keeps us honest is that we care about what we do, and we care about our credibility and our careers, and we care about the site, and so we don't write things that aren't true. And when I say that, I you know that you know, when we have a tag called rumor monger, which is like what you're reading is us telling you a rumor that we heard. You know, we don't present it as this is something we ran down and we know it to be true, but this is what people are saying. So we're honest in our presentation of the things, even when they're simply, when they might be just straight gossip, as opposed to reporting that we've actually done. But so that's what keeps us honest. The commenters keep us accurate. We make mistakes, and the commenters are there to point them out, and I value that tremendously. It's like having a fact-checking system.
In terms of the Rob Ford video, did you feel you had to write about it because, in fact, it was so visually compelling, even if you didn't have a bunch of background material and you couldn't say for sure? And
well, I mean, I felt I had to go try to find it because it would have been great video if it existed and showed what it purported to say. So that's why I came up here looking for it. And then when I saw it, I knew I had to write about it. Well, no, when I saw it, I knew I had to try to get it. And then when it turned out that it had gotten back to Ford and was starting to circulate around City Hall, the news of it, I should say, I felt I had to write about it because I didn't want to lose the story. I wanted to get out ahead of it. I wanted to break it. I didn't want someone else to break it. And I knew it was, you know, when things like that, an analog is, you know, Matt Drudge breaking the Monica Lewinsky story when Newsweek had it, but, you know, didn't run it. You know, stuff starts to get out and circulate, and I didn't want some Matt Drudge somewhere to have the story.
Hi, my name is Stavros. What interests you that's being done out there, kind of the journalism-ism space, content creation space? What do you suggest that's intriguing out there?
In terms of other places that I read, or?
Yeah, I mean, what's happening beyond Gawker that you look out as something contemporary, something, I don't want to say forward-thinking, but just, you know, mixing it up in a way that I think Gawker, by the reaction and kind of the pushback to it, is that it's, you know, doing things, I don't know, differently, let's say.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know in terms of forward thinking stuff, that there's anything that, you know, that really comes to mind. I mean, I feel bad. What's that? Well, I'm not a big fan of WikiLeaks because I think that WikiLeaks was sort of hijacked by a megalomaniac. He made it about himself and about his own persona and his own personality rather than about what it was supposed to be, which is a machine that acts independently of human beings to leak important information. For some reason what's coming to mind is that there are some places that are reacting against contraction of attention that web journalism causes. There are places that are reacting against how fast and cursory writing and reporting can be in this medium. So you have like the Baffler was a great old quarterly magazine that existed back in the 90s that has recently revived, that I'm a big fan of, that does long form argumentation and writing. The Long Reads is a group that finds and curates longer, more in-depth reporting and distributes it on Twitter on the most, you know, short read medium, but like to make sure that you can find things that actually that take time to read. And we publish a lot of very long things. I mean, we have every Saturday we publish a personal essay that's lengthy. So those are the things that come to mind. There are a lot of places that are reacting against this push to brevity and speed that I think are very useful.
Isn't there a problem, though, if I may just jump in for a second, isn't there a problem, though, that we're kind of diluting the sense of what journalism ought to be. There was a 18th century English economist called Gresham who came up with Gresham's Law, where he said, bad money drives out good. If you have a handful of coins and somebody says one of them is counterfeit, but we don't know which one, kind of all the coins in your hand then become suspect. And one of my worries is that as...
Who's the counterfeit in your argument?
Well, no, but this is about the quality of journalism. If journalism is being diluted in some way, because gossip is easy and it's fun and it attracts eyeballs, but it kind of pushes some of the other good stuff out of the realm of the possible. Mm. And my concern, my own worry is that media organizations will look at Gawker and say, we could do that too.
Actually, before I forget, I want to say also another thing that another place that I really like what they're doing online is the New York Review of Books' website, and their web strategy is great. And they have like Charles Simic, who's a wonderful poet and former poet laureate of the U.S., writing blog posts for them, and they're beautiful. It's like they've got brilliant people who do their sort of long form New York Review of Books stuff, and they're doing webby versions of it. I really like. In terms of the bad penny, we do gossip. We also published detailed financial accountings of Mitt Romney's holdings at Bain Capital. We had someone go to AJ Delorio, my former boss, went to Egypt to try to get into the Gaza Strip during the last Gaza war. And was stopped and couldn't get in, and then stayed in Cairo to cover the unrest there. We do, serious stuff, and we try to mix it up.
But that's not what you're known for.
Well, I mean, there's always a bigger audience for Chipotle videos than what's going on in Cairo.
But cheaper to do too.
Yeah, but we don't. We do invest resources and time. I am on the FBI's internal list of quote unquote vexum FOIA requesters, because I file so many Freedom of Information Act requests with the FBI that they've got a list of people, and I'm proud to be on that list. And my name is next to some very talented researchers and journalists. I preside over an organization that writes a lot about Miley Cyrus and Honey Boo Boo, but I also try to make sure, and every Gawker editor prior to me has made sure that we were trying to invest some of our time and resources in stories that pay off, not in terms of traffic and eyeballs, but in terms of scoops and stories that matter. And often those two align, and that's a great thing. The Mitt Romney Bain Capital documents was, in my view, a good, solid political campaign story, and also did really well. Adrian Chen, one of our great writers, did an amazing story that you would have read in the New York Times Magazine or The Atlantic, a quality, lengthy magazine journalism story about one of the most notorious trolls on the internet, who had made hundreds of lives miserable by posting upskirt photos of young girls and just being just a horrible, nasty man who was famous for being horrible and nasty. And Adrian unmasked him and identified him, and that was both a wonderful work of journalism, wonderful work of writing, and it did monster traffic. So sometimes those align for us, and that's the sweet spot that we're going for.
Thank you. There's so much. I almost forget what I want to ask. I'm Susan Reisler.
Name, please.
I'm Susan Reisler, and I think I'm going to say that I spent almost three decades working as a journalist. I'm from Jeffrey's Vintage, most of it at the CBC, and also learning on the job before the J schools became so popular. But what I want to sort of go beyond the conversation, in my mind, you're a journalist. and I'm almost sad listening to you because you're choosing not to come over and take that deep dive. And the concern that I have, and I'm interested in your perspective, is that more and more what we get are aggregate news sites, less independent journalism. We know that the media is suffering horribly, does not have the resources to do the stories. I mean, the Toronto Star is sticking its neck out following this Rob Ford story, and it would help if more people would follow it more often and so that they didn't get so exposed. So there are real issues in the media, and everything's just fine for you for the most part, and not just you, but people that are doing those websites, because so far, good information is still going to the mainstream newspapers, and that's having an impact on policy. And I think we forget that, you know, we sort of signed on to this business as journalists under that sort of headline of comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And that's sort of a mantra that I think we don't want to forget. What you're doing, albeit the main piece of the sandwich is entertainment. Every once in a while, there's a bit of special stuff that goes on the side, a little special sauce, which is the journalism that you talk about, but it's entertainment. But what is the future then if you are so successful that you become the mainstream and we drive out as and the business cannot sustain itself? And I guess I'm asking you, as a professional, as someone who really, I'm sure, understands this, and whether you worry about the consequences of your success.
I mean, I think the success of Gawker has in many ways moved some newspapers, and not just Gawker, there's other sites that are along the same lines. BuzzFeed has been a tremendously successful website that has had a profound impact on the way some newspapers operate. I think our success has, altered the behavior of some newspapers. One thing, first of all, we do afflict the comfortable. I mean, that's part of a huge part of what we do is to mock pompous fatheads. That's part of our job. And that's sort of part of what the Rob Ford coverage sort of fits into as well. But we do, comfort the afflicted. We up until recently, we did, almost a year, I think we were up to like 42 editions, we did a weekly post of just stories of the unemployed, where we would publish, people would send us in their accounts of what it's like to be unemployed, and we would publish them week after week after week, because we thought it was, it was important that our audience remember and understand that we have a huge unemployment problem in the United States. We have an ongoing coverage of Walmart and how they mistreat their employees. That's almost all just sourced from Walmart staffers who write in, that sparked Walmart to, on its internal website, ask its employees to start sending us in propaganda about how great they are. We do that stuff, not as special sauce on the side. That's like week in, week out, we do it. I want to hedge that and say, we are not, a public interest site. We are not out to, I don't have any sort of, I don't want to sound sanctimonious or like we're doing good in the world. We're not. But that's part of what we want to present to readers, those stories. And if we can put, there was a great debate that happened when there was the Washington Post ran a story about some like life coach type woman who was like her, she presented herself, she like sold herself to 20 somethings to help them get a job. And I wish I could remember the writer's name, Ian something. And it was a pretty like run-of-the-mill profile. And the woman that was being profiled was an idiot, and she was a charlatan, and she was ripping off these kids, and she didn't know what she was doing, and she said a number of very stupid things. And Hamilton Nolan, one of our writers, read that story and took the stupid things that she said and said, can you believe the stupid things that this woman says? And did a post, and it did very well. And the writer of the Washington Post story said, you ripped off my post. And he wrote about the experience, like, you stole my story. We didn't. It was credited. It was, but his point was like, you guys got all of the traffic that my story should have gotten. And the reason we got the traffic that his story should have gotten is because we were honest and funny and entertaining. And he wasn't. And I hope that has, convinced him and his editors, and I think it actually has, to try to be a little bit more funny and honest and entertaining, and most importantly, irreverent. That's what people, I think, are looking for online, is an honest voice that isn't, bathed in, this sense of self-importance. And that's what you get from so many newspapers. That's part of, in my view, the sort of culture of the priesthood and the professionalization of reporting has done, is it's fostered a sense of self-importance that actually gets into the way newspapers present their work. And I think people find honest, irreverent, funny blog posts to be refreshing.
And this is part of the John Stewartization of media now.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, as John Stewart would say, the Gawkerization of John Stewart. Next.
My name is Tim Knight. I write a column for the Huffington Post called Watching the Watchdog. And the Huffington Post is no great paragon of virtue.
Neither are you, Tim. So
what?
Neither are you, Tim. So that's
no, I was about to say that. Yes. As am not I, or something like that. No, my point about that, though, was, what was the lewd act that you referred to, by the way? Toward the beginning.
It's not. I mean, it's horrible. He was caught. He was filmed. The bodyguard was filmed. Masturbating to the passport photo of their child.
I see.
Sorry.
Move on?
Yeah.
I noticed that Michael Cook, who is the editor of The Star, wandered in earlier. I can't see him now, but I think he's here. And I was hoping he would be lining up here to be part of this. But I mention him because he comes out of a tabloid culture. British, Fleet Street, the Daily Mirror type of thing, the publish and be damned tradition. And I put it to you that so do you. So does HuffPost, with all its faults, and God knows they are manifold and manifest, that our profession, journalism, has always welcomed and rewarded the sleaze, as well as the New York Times and the former London Times. You are, in fact, a descendant of all those people, and I see no real reason to question the validity of the sort of work that you do. Do you?
Thank you, sir. I am.
You seem horrified that.
No, I don't like to be. I wrote a piece when the hacking scandal came down in the Murdoch papers. I wrote a piece called "In Defense of Sleazy Journalism." I didn't defend hacking, but the outrage over that started to metastasize into outrage over paying people for stories, and yeah. I was trying to say, hey, wait a minute, I'm an admirer of the British newspaper culture. I think American and Canadian newspaper culture could learn a lot from the way those folks operate. And it's ironic that they are also under the more stringent libel laws, so they're sort of more constricted at the same time. But there's a great tradition of people who want to mix it up and are not afraid of pissing people off.
Thank you.
Hey, John. I'm Eric Zaworski. I'm a fourth-year journalism major at Ryerson University.
Hi.
So before I ask my question, I just want to say you owe me a coffee, because when you tweeted about the Crackstarter video, I spat it right out onto myself and the people on the bus. So, so I'd like to know your thoughts on the increasing relationship between readers and readers and the audience as participants in covering news and stories, which you're trying to do with your comments on the Gawker website. And if Twitter to you represents the final straw with, you know, information publishing, or if now that it's, you know, decided to become public, it too will go, you know, it'll exhaust its usefulness one day.
Yeah, I don't know how going public will alter Twitter. I haven't really thought about that. I would imagine it would make it more ad dependent. I think ads, you know, I think inserting more commerce into the way Twitter operates is probably going to make it a not as fun experience for the people who use it. In terms of comments on Gawker, I mean, the idea is that there are conversations happening and in the world and online, and we want to facilitate those conversations, and we want to make Gawker and all of the Gawker sites places not just where you come and are presented with a curated news product that was produced by credentialed elites, but to create a space where anybody can communicate and discuss and comment and operate on par, on an equal level, where people can write on their little own Kinja pages. Things that if I'm interested in it, I can share it to press a button and make it show up on Gawker, and it can go from 2,000 page views or 100 page views or 3 page views to 400,000 page views, which is something that happened with something that a guy I know wrote on his Kinja page and I liked, and I put it on Gawker and 300,000 people read it. That's the idea that the other component of it is the ability to take a post that is on Gawker and one of the Gawker sites, and we call it reframing, where you take the post, but you then write your own headline and your own introduction to it and put your own image on it and reframe the post the way you want to. It's sort of the opposite of a comment. Comments are subordinate; they're below. The story is prioritized over it. This is a way to actually prioritize what you want to say about the story and get out of the story and present that on top. It's all about making it a space that's not simply about us deciding what the story is and presenting it to you. It's about readers joining in the discussion and letting readers help create what the stories are.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Brent Jolly. I'm glad to see you. Also, there's a lot of young people here, so my question's sort of coming in that vein as well. I'm curious to wonder, given, you know, the proliferation of internships and everything that's, you know, sort of benchmarked in the industry right now, interns that come into Gawker, for example, what kind of lessons do you like to impart on those journalists that they can take with them later on in their career? I'm a bit concerned because I hear, you know, there's the sort of political economy approach of, you know, the class, you know, not having elites being journalists, having more outside the box kind of regular journalists. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, how does those situations and the lessons that you perhaps impart through parachute journalism, et cetera, have an impact when those young reporters end up wanting to work for, I don't know, the Times or the National Post, the Globe and Mail, the Star, something like that?
In terms of political economy, we pay our interns. We call them fellows, which is a patriarchal term, I'm just realizing. But we pay them, not a lot, but we compensate them. You know, I mean, the lessons I want them to learn, they vary. They depend on who they are. Some, you know, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, it's intern work. It's transcribing interviews, which is a really great way to learn how to conduct good interviews by listening to them. But, you know, how to write fast, you know, how to take a story and put an angle on it that'll be of interest to people, which is, you know, a sort of essential, you know, that's an aggregating function, but it's also an essential function of any good reporter to take what you've got in front of you, not mm-hmm. a New York Times story that you're aggregating, but a story that you reported. How do you angle it? How do you find a way to make this, you know, how do you give this story a hook? How do you make people interested in it? How do you make people read to the bottom? Those are the same skills. But in terms of how that, you know, affects them when they go on to work at other places, I don't know. I mean, I hope we're teaching people how to report and write news in real time on the internet, and that's something that every newspaper and magazine either is doing or is going to go out of business. So,
does the sort of normative decline of journalism something that concerns you? The whole general talk. Sorry, that's two questions, but I'll shut up now.
What do you mean, Norman? Like, you mean the standards?
Whole,
or?
Yeah, the standards, the sort of the rigors that you would put your, like, you know, the two sources, make sure you're analyzing the facts, not just a he said, she said, kind of throw it in here with, you know, a nice kicker at the end.
You know, no. I like he said, she said stories. I think a lot of those norms are useful in certain instances, but I think generally they serve to, like I said, create barriers to entry for people, to tell people you can't do this, you're not a reporter, you haven't gone through these paces. And I think that, you know, with, I think, you know, these are skills that anybody can pick up and anybody can do. And, you know, we live in a world where it's very, you know, bad stories don't last very long. You know, some bad stories have a big flash, but they get debunked right away. It's very hard to have a bullshit story that sticks around in a real way, or an error that lasts longer than it should. I mean, things move very quickly, and anybody can correct and push back against bullshit. So I think those standards were more suited to an era when, you know, it was all one direction. It was all we own the printing press, and so we're the only ones that do. Or these other five papers. And, you know, errors were much more significant then because there was no way for them to get corrected in a quick way. And I think now it's just a different environment, and the technology has rendered those norms a little bit obsolete.
Okay. Thanks for your thoughts.
We have time for one more question.
Hi, my name is Bill Doskutch. I'm a journalist in Toronto. I just wanted to get your views on how Rob Ford has handled the whole Crackgate situation. He never sued anyone, you know. He just got up and basically said it's not true. You know, he famously deflected questions by saying anything else at the numerous press conferences afterwards when he was exposed to the media. And I think one poll showed not long after the whole imbroglio swelled up that his popularity actually increased. Have you seen a phenomenon like him in any other city in North America?
There's Marion Barry in Washington.
Yeah, but Marion Barry he resurrected himself as a councilman.
And he also, well, he did get reelected as mayor once, I believe.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
And he did it by going to the citizens of Washington and saying, I'm a sinner, you're a sinner.
Yeah.
Let's get together. And they put him back into office. And I think your point is that if Rob Ford were to do that, I'm not sure we have enough Baptists in Toronto anymore, but we'll see if that might work.
He's a phenomenal politician. You got to hand it to him. I mean,
but point, just point of order, he did not deny it. Like the only thing that he said is, I am not smoking crack right now, and I am not addicted to crack. But he has never said, I have never smoked crack, to my knowledge. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think he's ever said I've never smoked crack, and I don't think he's ever said I was never filmed smoking crack.
But I guess one of the things that sort of disciplines the media is the threat of a lawsuit. And here you have a guy who basically turned that on its head. And the media is the one that winds up looking less credible as a result. What lessons should we draw from that?
I mean, does the media end up looking less credible? I mean, the fallout of the story, I guess his support has increased, but my sense is that's a sort of truther movement. Like these are people who are not going to believe it no matter what the evidence is. He's got that kind of core I can't imagine very many people who can look at the totality of his behavior after those stories broke, and who would be convinced by the publication of the video. You know, I think it's just they've hardened. They're just hardened supporters. I mean, I think a lot of people are probably okay with it. You know.
Well, that was. Yes, that's time. Can I just say one more thing? I wanted to thank you very much for putting up with these rude and un-Canadian questions. I was reading in the most recent edition of the Columbia Journalism Review about the definition of what is a journalist. And Mark Ambinder wrote in a little blurb there, said, the best thing that a journalist can do is evoke one response from a reader, which is, wait, what? And suddenly, the person who is receiving the content, the recipient of the journalist, his or her life is kind of shaken up and changed. And I think that's what Gawker does. So I wanted to thank you very much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you, everybody.
Hi, I'm Natalie Turvey, Executive Director with the CJF. And on behalf of the Foundation, I want to thank Jeffrey for moderating tonight's debate, a fascinating, provocative discussion about journalistic ethics and standards. And I hope we can continue the conversation at the cocktail. On behalf of the Foundation, I'd like to thank our exclusive JTalk series sponsor, BMO Financial Group, for their tremendous support of CJF JTalks, as well as our in-kind sponsors, CPAC and CNW Group, for their work promoting the series. I'm thrilled to see a packed house for our first event of the season and a lot of familiar faces. So thanks to all of you for coming out tonight and supporting CJF events. Coming up, we have a JTalk with journalist-turned-bestselling author Linwood Barclay, who's proving there is life after journalism. And in the spring, Kirsten Stewart joins us to talk about Twitter's plans in Canada, and we'll have a conversation about the challenges to conventional news gathering. So I hope you can join us for those events. I invite you to stay with us for the cocktail in the back of the room, and see you soon. Thanks.